Today on the Out of Chicago podcast, we have landscape photographer and former art historian Aaron Bobnick. Well, welcome back to the Out of Chicago podcast. I'm your host, Chris Smith, and today we're talking with one of my favorite landscape photographers, and she's going to be with us at the Out of Acadia Landscape Photography Conference. It's Aaron Bobnick. We'll have that interview coming up in just a minute. But before we do that, let me tell you a little bit about everything we have going on with Out of Chicago. This year we have two big events still left. First off, the fourth annual Out of Chicago Photography Conference. It's at the end of June, June 23rd through the 25th. There are still spots left, and we hope you might be able to join us. And our other big event this year, as we just said, it's the Out of Acadia Conference. I think we have like three spots left for the conference. So if you're interested in joining us, you got to jump on it right away. We're limiting it to 100 people. We got 97 people signed up. So you do the math. So hopefully you can join us in Maine. It's October 1st through the 5th and a couple spots left. Hope you can join us. For each of these, just go to outofchicago.com. You'll see all the information there. The other big thing this week, oh my goodness, we released, and this is why it's so hard to do this podcast and everything else. I got to get better at doing all this, but we released the second edition of The Photographer's Guide to Chicago. The original version came out in 2013, and it was time to update it. We spent a ton of time on it. Michelle Kuhn helped me out a ton, and we've got all new images. We got everything else. It's a great book. If you go to outofchicago.com/book, you can download a free copy. It's going to be free until the end of May. So go grab that copy and tell your friends about it. So today on the show, one of my favorite landscape photographers. She's a former art historian. She's got a great background. You're going to hear about it in this interview. And it really, you know, it kind of guides the way that she photographs now. But you really got to check out Aaron Bobnick's images because they're just amazing shots. It has to do with her post-processing, but it also is that she's just really knows composition. So put that all together, and she's just a phenomenal photographer. I can't wait to hang out with her. Actually, I haven't met her in person before. Oh, no, I take it back. I did meet her very briefly at Photo Plus Expo, and she was hanging out with Josh Cripps, and Josh is coming and teaching at our June conference, and she's going to be at our Acadia conference. So we're going to, but I'm really looking forward to hanging out for more than like 2 minutes. And so we're all going to be out in Acadia. That's going to be great, and she's going to be leading people to different locations. She's going to be teaching. She's going to be teaching composition. She's going to be teaching this art history background to it, so it's going to be special. We've got so many great speakers, and each one is lending kind of their own little take on photography. And you come for that 5 days with us, and you're just going to immerse yourself in landscape photography, and it's going to be one of the best weeks of your life, so don't miss it. All right, so let's get right into the interview. This is Aaron Bobnick. All right, welcome to the Out of Chicago podcast. I am here with landscape photographer extraordinaire Aaron Bobnick. Hi, Aaron.
Hi, Chris.
I'm going to do a whole intro earlier, but whatever. I mean, I already said it. And I've totally screwed the whole thing up now. But yeah, I'm so excited to have you on the show. You're going to be with us in Acadia National Park, and you've been traveling all over the world. So yeah, I don't know. Tell us a little bit about like your background. How'd you get into this? I mean, the crazy part is you're actually like an art historian. What's the right word?
Yeah. Oh my God. That's it.
Terrible intro. Keep going, Aaron.
Yeah, I guess I'm a bit unusual in that regard, that I came into photography through art history. That was because I was producing an archive of photographs for teaching and research and got really into it. It became a very slippery slope for me. So I was out there creating archaeological photographs because my specialty in art history was ancient art. I was sort of a de facto archaeologist. Not sort of, I was. I excavated for many years in Israel. And also just needed to have a command of archaeological materials pretty much all over Europe and the Middle East, and traveled extensively to see them, to photograph them, also to see and photograph archaeological sites. And I got really good at that, to where people started wanting to hire me to do it for them. And I did that for many years. I was doing assignment photography.
It can't be that many years because you're not that old, I can tell. Yeah.
Oh, you're very kind, and I'm not giving anything more away than that. Right, there you go. But no, actually, okay, it was maybe 5 years, something like that, that period lasted. And yeah, and so then that led to stock work, and eventually I really got frustrated with all of that, because there are a lot of limitations, especially with working with archaeological sites. You can't go into them during certain hours, or if you do, you can't take a tripod, or if you want to get around both of those limitations, you have to, you know, actually go and meet with people and have interviews with them and get special exceptions, especially the Greeks. They're very, you know, you can't just write. You kind of have to go show up and talk to them. So I know after a while that just got old. I really enjoyed working outdoors and photographing these magnificent Greek temples and whatnot. But ultimately, because I'd always been into nature and backpacking and everything, I just thought, why don't I just take my camera up there into the mountains? That would be fun too.
And that was really like one of the first questions I wanted to ask was like, why was it that you got into landscape photography? So the art history and the archaeology, all that, that makes sense. But I think what you just said kind of nails it, because so many photographers, whether it's like Galen Rowell or Art Wolf or whoever, they started out hiking in the mountains and then they're like, I think I'll bring my camera. So it sounds like you've got basically the same story.
Yeah, in the end, you know, it's basically I just gravitated into doing what I always did, but this time with the camera. And I think a lot of people, you know, they might have a different background, maybe not art history, but it's a similar kind of path. Yeah.
Yeah. So talk a little bit more about this in the art history. And you lead tons of workshops. You're going to be teaching in Acadia with us. And yeah. How does that apply then to what you do now?
Oh, there's a lot of carryover. Back when I was excavating in Israel, we got up really early, well before sunrise. We got out into, you know, very kind of remote areas, got very dirty. There was a lot of, you know, all of this is the same sort of thing in landscape photography. I got to teach, I got to research, I got to write, you know, I got to sit with students and discuss really deep thoughts with them. And I'm doing all of that as a landscape photographer as well. But in addition, I have, you know, this wonderful creative freedom that I did have it as an art historian, but in a different way. And this, it just enables me to put everything together that really makes me tick. And I love it. I'm very happy.
And are you able to use like some of the ideas of like, you know, how art has evolved over the years or whatever? I mean, this is not my background for sure. Like I said, I taught physics, but
yeah, absolutely. Even my recent talk that I've been doing a lot and that will become one of my seminars in Acadia. I'm actually giving it in San Francisco for Canon next month. Regards that very thing. So I'm discussing composition, but starting from an historical perspective and looking at how issues like aesthetics that relate to photography actually have evolved over the years, even though it's a small length of time that photography has even existed in the grand scheme of things. It does have this ancient past, you know, that that we're drawing from this whole history of art. And even within this short window of time, things are evolving. There are trends in landscape photography. And I think that if I didn't have my background in art history, it would be difficult for me to put a finger on all of this and be able to put that into perspective for people. So that's really nice. But as far as it just relates to my own work, you know, having that background, you know, it just really helps to have a great understanding of the visual principles that all art forms have in common, you know, that, you know, studying a wide variety of artworks can help to illuminate how those principles operate in general and how to leverage them for effect in any particular case. And I feel very comfortable not only working with these ideas, but also discussing them with students. So I have my education, I think, to thank for that. Also, one thing I learned as an art historian that's very important in that field is understanding how images can be bearers of meaning, how they can generate meaning. So the idea of the story in the photograph, I think about that a lot. That has become just part of my psyche as an art historian, and I enjoy that a lot too. That maybe more so in the editing stage, But sometimes also when I'm in the field and I look at things and I see connections and metaphors that help inform what I'm doing, everything from composition to timing to what have you.
I think that's a really tough one for new photographers or old photographers, that you hear that all the time. Your photo should tell a story. But it doesn't mean, like, at first when I heard that, I'm like, okay, well, I better have a story about a person walking over this mountain. And it doesn't mean that, though. I mean, right. give a little bit more about that, would you?
Yeah, well, it's not exactly Jack and Jill went up the hill. Yeah, I mean, you can press that too far for sure. Mm-hmm. But no, I mean, sometimes these are ideas that are pretty abstract. You know, photos don't speak in the way that stories that are written do, but they can express a lot. So even if it's something that's, you know, like a cloud around a mountain peak, it's sort of like Beauty and the Beast, where one sort of mingling with the other, or, you know, light at the end of a gorge is sort of like, you know, that light at the end of the tunnel, that there's something good coming, or, you know, and these are things that aren't necessarily going to be the same for the photographer and the viewer. And that's okay. I don't think that these ideas need to have that kind of one-to-one relationship. There's a philosopher, Richard Vohlheim, who said that the artist will always intend more than the viewer sees, and the viewer will always see more than the artist intends. That's the way art works, and there's nothing wrong with that. But I think that a really compelling photograph will stimulate these sorts of emotions, ideas, and concepts for people, even if they're not the same as what the artist had in mind. There's something there, you know, they have that depth to them.
Yeah, and I think that makes sense. Ideas, emotions, what was the other thing you just said?
Concepts. Yes, yeah, metaphors.
Yeah, more than, you know, a linear story that you're telling. Right. Like, yeah. I'm looking at one of your images here, and I was going to ask you, like, what are some of your favorite images? But I look in your portfolio, and it says, like, my favorite images or personal favorites. There you go. So
yeah.
I'm looking at one of your images of the sand dunes, and there's a storm passing over the top of it, and and just the feeling that you get from looking at that, and the way you've composed it has really made that sink in to the viewer. So I think that's what you mean by the story. I really like that.
Thanks. Yeah, you chose one of my very favorites.
Yeah, well, that one just popped out to me. I love it. So
thanks.
Sure. You know, and I can't let this one go, but you said a minute ago that it's interesting for you to follow, like, the trends in landscape photography. What do you think the trends are right now? What do you see? What, like, because I kind of see it, but I can't put my finger on it sometimes. Like, I see, okay, a lot of these images look similar for some reason, you know, amongst a lot of them that you might see on 500px or something like that. But what do you think are some of the modern trends in landscape photography?
I'll just respond to that with regards to composition, because that's part of the talk and what I've been working on mostly. But for example, when landscape photography first started to really even exist as a genre, books quickly started coming out with ideas about how it should be done. And they're very prescriptive, you know, they're like, this is what you do, this is how it is done. And one of those tips in one of these really old books. I use it in my talk. It's from, I think, from the late 19th century. It's really actually a fabulous book in the way that it's kind of comical and fun to read, and for, you know, with that kind of perspective. But they talk about how, you know, you should never let anything that is the highest point in a scene fall along the central axis of a photo. And that actually is a go-to compositional solution these days, because it's actually the reason I think that preference for counterbalance existed back in the day over 100 years ago was because they were coming out of other genres where it's actually fairly difficult to break up symmetry. So if you're working with architecture, for example, which is what they were when they started out, you know, photographing outdoors, that's what they had, that's what wasn't moving. They needed to do these 10-hour exposures, and so, you know, they had to find things that weren't going to move. So when they got into art history, I think some of that was just landscape photography, some of that was just a carryover. But actually, in actuality, if you put a mountain peak in the middle of the frame, chances are it's going to be, objects on either side of it, features on either side of it, that give you opportunities for creating counterbalance around that central point. And this has been a go-to solution these days for, I think, for a lot of photographers, is that rather we're seeing less counterbalance now and more of this approach to the sort of the central anchor and then lesser important objects sort of balanced around that, rather than the call and response kind of something big on the left and something balancing it on the right. Mm-hmm. People still do that, but I think that the pendulum has swung the other way these days.
And as I'm looking through your portfolio, like this picture of, it's got to be like Joshua Tree National Park, the Joshua trees, it's exactly what you're talking about with the one in the center and then the smaller ones or ones that are further away off to the side and then the big sunburst just off to the side. So I love it.
Thank you.
Yeah. Oh, man, you have amazing images. Oh,
I appreciate that. Thank you.
We're in the middle of an interview, but yeah, you're great. Okay, so that's actually my next question is, how did you learn to get so amazing? The question is really, so you're great. So I wanted to say that. But the question is really like, is it because of this background or did you sit down and say, I really want to get a lot better and you went to a lot of online resources or what is it? What was your process to get to this point? Because no one gets here just automatically.
Yeah, well, I do have the benefit of a pretty substantial education in the arts. So I've all the way from art school through PhD, I've been focused on the arts my entire adult life, really. And I think that helps a lot. Back when I first started with photography, there surely were workshops, but not so many of them. And I actually didn't even know that was a thing, that even existed when I first started. So I probably would have advanced even more quickly had I had that opportunity to join workshops. But I basically, when I picked up photography specifically, transitioned pretty easily into it just because I had this background. But I also did a lot, everything that I could to help it along. So, you know, I connected with other photographers once I was able to. I talked a lot with them. I sought out critique of my photographs. You know, I read widely about the art of photography, and I really just tried to become a good student of it, you know, to, even though I had taken classes on the history of photography before, I knew quite a bit about that. You know, I really wanted to get more into ideas about photography practice. And of course, just doing a ton of it helps a lot.
Yeah. And it sounds like just to learn the craft as well. Like you've been looking at a lot, but now you're like, okay, I'm going to do this myself.
Yeah.
Do you have one or two books or online resources that you would recommend for people?
Oh, my goodness. You know, I would say, although this is kind of vague, I would say that it would be great for a beginning landscape photographer to immerse themselves in art history in general. And just because really that was something that was really hammered into me in my education at UC Berkeley was the benefit of cross-disciplinary studies to understand how aesthetics work in a variety of media. So I would encourage people not only to read everything that they can find about photography, but also about other media. And to seek out critique, look for forums online where you can put up your photographs and you can find a sort of some trusted feedback there that goes beyond, you know, little likes and whatever you get on social media, because that is a lot less valuable than people who are willing to sit there and talk about your images. But for sure, you know, workshops, there are a lot of great videos out there. And yes, Photocascadia is an excellent source for all of that sort of thing. Magazines, I would say also, one of my favorites is On Landscape magazine. I recently spoke at their conference out in England, and that is one of those more long-form, thoughtful types of magazines where, you know, it's you can get into more in-depth ideas that can be, I think, very instructive.
And you mentioned Photocascadia. You're one of the members there and one of the writers for that site. Is that correct?
Yes.
Along with
who? There are seven of us.
John Bagshaw. Oh, then you got to name five more. A bunch of you're the only woman, is that right?
That's right. Yeah. They didn't have one for 6 years. The group started, but I guess it's coming up on 8 years now. And for the first 6 years, they caught a lot of flack for not having a female. And they actually had it in their frequently asked questions. Why don't you have a female member? And the answer was, well, nor when we find her.
Oh, and they did. And they did. And from what I see on Facebook and everything, it seems like you're just one of the guys with them. So it sounds
Awesome. They really are my good friends. I absolutely dearly enjoy being around them. And yeah, that was a huge part of it. They really wanted that dynamic. Lots of groups form like Photocascadia and fail. And the reason that it has stayed together is because of that great group dynamic. And they wanted to make sure they retained that.
And you haven't screwed it up. That's good.
No, yeah, not yet.
Good job. So speaking of like female landscape photographers, that was one thing I wanted to ask you is, you know, who are some other females that we might follow? Because we're always looking for inspiration. We want to learn, you know, a lot of women that come to our things. And I just went through the numbers and I think we had 50.5% last year at our Out of Chicago conference were women. So just over half of them were female, and they want role models. So you're a perfect one if they're looking to do landscape photography. But who are a couple other women that people might follow?
Well, a couple who come to mind right away. Firstly, I want to mention Sarah Marino, because not only do I really enjoy her work, but also she put together a wonderful resource for exactly this question. She compiled a list of some 200 female nature photographers, something like that. I think it started with about 100 and then she kept expanding.
I'm going to interrupt you, actually. Yeah. I'm going to be really mean to her and I shouldn't say this, but I saw that blog post and I was like, this is exactly what I needed, because it was written for people that are putting together events like we're doing in Acadia.
Uh-huh.
This is amazing. And so I emailed her and I said, we would love to have you come and teach at Acadia. I really shouldn't, maybe I should edit this out. But I said, we'd love to have you come, Sarah. And she emailed me back like 4 days ago. So like 8 months after, she's like, I never saw this email or something. So,
yeah. So, well, yeah. She has been in the process of moving.
That's what
and
she said.
Very,
yeah,
very
yeah.
busy. Yeah. She and I actually discussed over a year ago, trying to get a workshop together, just the two of us, because I would really love to work with a female at some point. And I think that she and I, because our styles are very different, would make a really good combination, would have a lot to offer there. And we both loved the idea. We wrote up this kind of detailed proposal, and there it stayed, because we are both so busy. It's just really hard to...
So it's all ready to go. You just got to pull
the trigger. Yeah, we will. It's, yeah.
No, that's great. And and if everything works out, it would be great to have both of you guys in 2018, wherever we may go.
Yeah,
great. Don't want to give away any secrets or anything, but somewhere amazing. So she put together, this whole list of all these female photographers. So I totally threw you off track. Did you want to finish your thought on that?
Oh, no, I just would say, just wanted to say, you know, for everyone I could mention, there would be a bunch who I didn't mention. But one also who comes to mind, who really just touched me recently, I was introduced to the work of Michaela Griffith, who's a British landscape photographer. And she works on intimate scenes, abstracts, almost exclusively. And she has this series that she presented in England on just basically little reflections in water and this sort of thing. And a lot of people do that, but she does it with this incredible sort of depth and very sort of really neat self-direction. She's very, to hear her speak about it and to see the images, I just was really moved by it. I thought it was really terrific. And she has a whole portfolio of other little vignettes of nature that she focuses on. Sarah's similar in that regard. She's also known for her small scene nature images. And I guess I'm drawn to those two in particular because I do only a little bit of that. And so I like to see that variety, and I really enjoy seeing people who are so good at it and so dedicated to it.
Well, I'll have to check her out. Michaela Griffith. Okay.
Yeah.
Excellent. Well, thank you for a couple of those. That's perfect. And how about your workshop? So you said you just got back. You did like 5 in a row or something. And where were you again?
Pretty crazy. First three, I am. It's true. The first three were in a huge wide-ranging area of the Eastern Sierra, going all the way from Mona Lake down into Southern Death Valley. And I taught those with my co-leader, Ted Gore. And then I did two just that I was teaching on my own that are my masterclass series. And those were based entirely within Death Valley National Park. So basically all in that area there. And it was a lot of time out in the field, 28 nights in a tent of that 6 weeks that I was out there.
Wow.
So, yeah. But, you know, pretty fantastic. I really enjoyed it. I saw some spectacular moments of nature while I was out there all that time. It's so great to just see the transition between seasons that happens in that period and to be there for the whole thing. Yeah. It was really wonderful.
So you're talking earlier about how you've learned all this stuff, whether you've, you know, read some books or you go into these online forums, but there really is nothing like actually being with the photographer that you're trying to learn from. So, you know, tell people some things that, you know, what is it about a workshop that makes it different than just going, you know, reading a book or going online and trying to learn about it?
Oh yeah, that's a great question because there's really a lot. And a lot of it does have to do with that immersion in the location that you get, that connection with it, understanding it spatially, understanding light, and being able to stand there and talk about these things. And why am I standing here and not 10 feet over there? Why is my tripod at this height and not something else? Why are we here now? You know, when I do these workshops out in the Eastern Sierra, they're sort of, they have a very loose itinerary, so they're very focused on the weather also, because we can go to so many different locations within a small area. I have a wide range of choices to make, and I'm constantly consulting a bunch of weather resources to put people in the best possible situation for photogenic conditions. But then also, if we get somewhere and, you know, conditions are just difficult because the weather doesn't want to cooperate, well, then, you know, we can discuss what our options are there. And so you get really learn to think on your feet, to understand weather, light, locations in a way that you just can't unless, you know, you're right there with someone who can discuss it with you and show it to you and explain it to you. So I feel like that is one of the best benefits that you get. But also, for example, in my masterclass series, I combine seminars with the shooting. So I do a talk on the history of landscape photography. I do a big one on composition. And then I also do one on personal expression and creative development, which is all about the participants. So we discuss their favorite images from their own portfolios and try to draw a line through them and put a finger on where they seem to be coming from and maybe where they seem to be going. And these are always incredibly fruitful and I think have a big impression on the people in the workshops. And it's, you know, these are the sorts of things that really just happen in a very special way when you're all there in a group together in person.
Yeah. And we're going to try and do a lot of those same things in Acadia with the
critique
and going out and shooting and the seminars as well, put it all together. It's just that there's going to be a lot of photographers and a lot of instructors. So
it's a fabulous idea.
Yeah.
Really excited about that.
We'll see. It always works well here in Chicago. And I'm just so excited. I think it's going to be great in Acadia. We only have maybe 10, 15 spots left. We're limiting it to 100 people. So,
wow.
So yeah. So
it's going to sell out fast.
It is going to sell out fast. That's right. So, you know, I can't remember what class or classes are you teaching in Acadia? Is it the history one? Is it the, do you remember?
I've got the composition one, one on post-processing, and then a critique seminar.
That's right. So the first one was the composition. Tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah, well, I've already said a bit about it. This is the talk that I'm giving for Canon month. And I've already done it as it wasn't the keynote speech, but it was a program for a convention in Oregon. And I gave it once in Berkeley. But this is the idea that I that most academics employ, that if you're writing a book, which I am, about this topic, you go on tour with these ideas and you see how people respond to them. What are people getting out of it? What more would they like, so that you can really put out a good product when you get around to it? And this one has been very, very well received. And I keep working with it. It keeps evolving. Every time I give it, it's a little different. So it should be really refined by the time I get it over to Acadia.
Yeah.
It'll be my fourth or fifth time giving it. So it's a look at composition starting from ancient art all the way from there, and also looking at composition not only in terms of its practical concerns, but also, as I spoke earlier about, its ability to generate meaning. So how composition can help push forward those ideas that make a photograph really resonate. So I have, you know, the conceptual, the practical, the historical, all kind of woven together in there.
Yeah, I can't wait. So what locations are you super excited to shoot in Acadia? And I don't think you've been there, is that correct?
I have not. I've been researching it a whole lot, and I hope to, you know, really find it as just as beautiful as everything I'm showing promises it to be, and I'm sure I will.
Well, and you know what? Let me stop you to say that we do this intentionally, that we love to have photographers that know the location better than anybody else, but we also love to have that excitement of photographers that have never been there before, too, and discovering it for the first time. So I think that mix is going to be really good.
Yeah, you know, I've actually had people more than once contact me for private workshops in places they know I've never been, saying, I want to see how you would approach it.
Exactly. Yeah, that's exactly right.
Yeah. But you start with the research, and that's what I've been doing, researching it a lot.
So we sent you Colleen's book, Colleen Minnick-Sperry's book, Photographing Acadia National Park, and you told me that you've promised me now that you're marking it up and looking through it. And, like, what types of shots do you envision are going to work for you? Like, where are you excited to go there? Is it the forests? Is it the seascapes? Is it all the above? What do you think?
Yeah, you know, even though I am known for probably more dramatic and grandiose kind of scenes, I am really attracted to some of the more intimate options there. Those forests are ablaze with color that time of year. And so I'm really excited to find some areas where we can get in there and work with the foliage, in addition to getting out to at least to do a seascape or two as well. But there are some places that look very interesting, even some very small scenes like the Waterfall Bridge, but up high, Cadillac Mountain is interesting to me, and the Gorham Mountain Trail. It looks like there's just a lot to do there.
And it's all close, and all those reasons are why we picked Acadia, rather than having to drive 2 hours or to camp, like you were saying, that we're close to Bar Harbor, and all those locations are 20, 30 minutes away.
Yep.
So I think it's going to be really good for that. Here, this one's putting me on the spot a little bit. Like, there's other photographers that are going to be there. Who do you know, or who are you excited to hang out with? We've got, you know, I think you know Nick Page. I think you've been on their interviews before. Like, who else do you know?
You know, Brian Peterson, really. Yeah. From way back in the day, I was familiar with his book, his you know, best-selling book, Understanding Exposure. Yeah. I'm very excited to meet him. But also, I've never met Nick, although I was on his podcast. I've never met him, and we talk a bit on Facebook, so I think it's going to be great to finally get an opportunity to see him in person.
Mm-hmm. Yep, and Colleen will be there. And,
yeah, Colleen, of course.
And she's great. And YouTube extraordinaire Thomas Heaton will be coming from the UK
right,
as well.
That's right.
So, yeah, it should be really exciting. Okay, join us in Acadia. Go to outofchicago.com, and there's links. You can sign up to go to Acadia. Not you, Aaron, but you're already going. All right, let's talk a little bit about gear, and then I think we'll wrap things up here. So big question with landscape photographers, do you use filters? Do you use graduated filters? What do you do when you're out there?
Yeah, it's interesting. This is a really crazy time for filters these days. I think I get contacted by a different filter company just about every month wanting to send me all of their filters so that I'll try them out and recommend them to students and whatnot. So I really have, my pick of the litter as far as that goes. For about the last 6 years, I have not been using graduated filters. Since I got into exposure blending, they sit in the closet and collect dust. So when people offer those to me, I say, no, you know what? I'll never use them. So don't send me those. Recently I've acquired a monster lens, the Canon 11-24mm. Mm-hmm. And the only way to put filters on that thing, it's like satellite dish. That goes on
exactly.
And for that, I'm using a circular polarizer. I do like doing long exposures, so I have a 10-stop ND for it. And that would be the same for all of my lenses. So I have CPLs and and NDs for solid NDs for everything that I've got. And that's really kind of it. I also have UV filters because I do get out into areas where I feel like it helps to have a little protection on the lens.
Yeah, you said you get down and dirty quite a bit when
Yep. Mm-hmm. those have to come off if I'm shooting into the sun usually or something like that, because I don't want any extra flare, but that's kind of it. So even though I have a lot of access to filters, I don't use the full suite of them that some people do. I know a lot of people love using grads. They are absolutely beneficial in certain situations if you don't want to get into blending. But if you're okay with a little chair time after you've taken the picture, it does make things come out a little more cleanly.
Yeah, so let's talk about that. What do you use for your exposure blending? And I mean, don't go in depth, but just give us a general rundown of what you do in post-processing.
Well, I use Lightroom and Photoshop. And I always tell my students that everyone's probably these days heard the term luminosity masks, and I do use them, but I also tell people that one of the best things to know about them is when not to use them. And I have some tips and tricks of my own that work with masking that is not of the luminosity sort, and some that are in combination with luminosity masks, and then some that are just lots of luminosity maskings. So I have a whole range of techniques, and I'll be showing some of those in Acadia, that address different sorts of problems that landscape photographers face. But yeah, I do a lot of masking, sometimes it's all from a single raw file, double processed, triple processed, quadruple processed.
So like processing it four different ways, you're saying, like with different exposures or whatever,
right?
All from one raw file.
Right. Yeah. So process it differently and then put them all together and blend them in selectively so I can have control over color and tonality across the scene wherever I want it, however I want it. And sometimes I do need to shoot bracketed shots and work those together too.
And if you do that, what are you doing? 3, 5, 7 shots typically?
I usually don't need more than 3, and that's usually enough to handle it. As far as just for dynamic range or something like that, that's usually enough.
Right. Should I ask you what camera you use? Oh my goodness.
Sure.
Because I know people are listening going, if she only needs 3, she must have a good camera. And what? It's not an old model or something. Yes, go ahead.
I'm using now the Canon 5D Mark IV, but I was working this way with the Mark III as well, which was a sensor that was a lot less forgiving as far as dynamic range goes. But really, it's the rare case when I would need up to maybe 5 or so. I mean, there are some that I have where the dynamic range is that great, where I might be up around 5 exposures or something like that. But the way that I work is you can usually get most of the scene in a few. And then if there's this one little area, like right around the sun or something, I'll just do a shot just for that. So I don't need everything in between. Because I can double, triple, quadruple process each of those raw files, in the end, maybe I do have something that is somewhere along the lines of 7 or something like that, but they really generated from a few.
That makes sense. Yeah. Yeah. Well, we won't go into it. Yeah, I agree. Sometimes you do too many and yeah, you don't need it, or it could, yeah.
Better to have too many than too few, but that's
good point.
Yeah. And that's the same with focus stacking, for example. You know,
that was my next question. Yeah. So yeah, do you do focus stacking for a lot of your images? What's the deal?
I do. Yeah. Because I do a lot of working with, close to the ground compositions where you have something very close to the lens. And so, yes, I do quite a bit of focus stacking. And when I teach that in the field, I always tell people, you know, better too many than too few. You can always throw out those files, but you can't make up a lost focus point.
How often do you do that? Only if you have a real prominent subject in the foreground, or most of the time? How often?
Well, I mean, usually I do prefer to have sharpness all the way through a frame. It's a rare case, if any, that I've done recently where I actually want large out of focus areas. So I would say that I always do whatever I can to make sure that I've got front to back sharpness. This is with the grand landscapes. And generally think, if the focus really fades out, it can be distracting. So I try to keep things in focus. And if I'm really close to the ground, then that right there determines how many focus points I need or whether or not I even need to do that. With the Canon 11-24, I'm having to do less of it than ever.
And so do you do it manually? Do you have like some sort of program or, I don't know, there's,
in my processing sessions, I teach how to do it in Photoshop, 2 different ways. So manually.
I asked a bad question. I meant, do you shoot it manually?
Oh,
you can
use
like a Cam Ranger or something, and it'll take it at different, you know, distances out. Or do you shoot it manually?
No. I just shoot it manually because, okay. I mean, I can blow through a whole focus range really quickly. I just put my lens in manual mode. I look down. I'm actually looking at the lens's little focus window, and I note where the closest point is, and then I just blow all the way through to infinity. Turn, click, until I get through that whole range. And once you've done this a lot, you know what kind of increments you need to use. They have to be smaller on the closer end, and then they can get wider. Your jumps can get bigger as you get closer to infinity. But the reason they do it that way is because if things are moving really quickly, the light is changing, clouds are going really quickly, and I realize I need to reshoot that foreground because now the light on it has changed, and I need to capture that and to go with whatever's going on in the background, I can just really quickly look at the front of the lens, move over very quickly to where that first point was because I know where it was, and then just go through really quickly. I can do that in seconds, and I don't have to fuss with anything. It's not fiddly.
No, I agree. Yeah, it's once you get the system down, that sounds perfect. Yeah, I'm gonna go shoot after this, and I know it's not good light here on this side of the world, but I'm gonna go. I'll try that. I'll try it out. So the better question: what do you do to put these all together then afterward?
Oh, okay. Yeah. So that's Photoshop. And sometimes it's just a real easy manual. If there are just two or three focus points, I can just do that manually, especially if things are moving around. You know, if you have flowers or something that are kind of blowing in the wind, usually a manual blend is the easiest way to go.
By manual, like there's people that are amazing like you that are like, okay, I totally get this, but there's other people that don't.
So, okay.
Take a few layers and just paint in parts.
Yes. Like manually painting the masks in.
Yeah.
Or using selections or something manually, as opposed to having Photoshop auto blend, which it can do. And it actually, contrary to what a lot of people say, it does a pretty darn good job of it. And I have a system for finding and fixing where it misses bits. And I have one sequence of something like 9 different focus points that I use in one of my processing demonstrations that are flowers. Things are moving around. You know, there's a little bit of wind. And that's a lot of focus points, and Photoshop handles it beautifully. You know, there are a couple little areas that need touch up, and I show people how to do that very quickly in a way that's really similar to working in something like Xerene or picking what the other one is that a lot of people use, but I don't use those because I have a method that works pretty well in Photoshop.
No, that's perfect. All right. We've been going way too long, but I'm going to ask you a couple more. One more.
Mm-hmm.
Two more.
Okay.
So what are like your favorite places in the world? What do you have for upcoming workshops? Those are kind of the two questions together. I would assume that they kind of go together possibly. So
yeah, I have my Dolomite series kicking off in July, and that's pretty exciting. I have 3 different sessions there, one with Alexandre Deschamps from France, one with Ted Gore from California, and one with Chip Phillips from Washington. And those are some of my favorite workshops because I really love that area, the atmosphere, the craggy mountains, the photos that come out of it are just so varied and so much fun. It changes from, you know, from session to session so much. I really enjoy it. I've also got a workshop with an Italian photographer co-leading, Enrico Fossati, in the French Alps this June.
Wow.
That's the first time. We've been researching that for years and finally put it together. And that's exciting. I'm doing Hawaii with Ted Gore in January. I'm going to do both the Big Island and Kauai all in one really amazing tour where we have two boat photography tours, a heli flight. Really a great all-inclusive trip. Got the Acadia conference coming up. Really looking forward to that. I also have Redwoods. I have Oregon Coast. I'm pretty busy.
You're a busy girl, yes. Yeah. That is crazy. But you're doing what you love. So that's the best part.
That's right.
Oh, that's really good. Well, where can people find you online? What's the best place for people to type in or just type in your name?
ErinBabnick.com is for sure the best place to go, but also Photocascadia. I'm there as well with links to my website and a little gallery and all of my writing goes there. And I'm also on Facebook and I try to be pretty active there, although obviously my travel schedule limits me a little bit in that regard. And Instagram.
Yeah.
Also on Instagram.
Yeah. Gosh, you got amazing images. People need to go check them out. So go check out Erin Bobnick and come to Acadia, hang out with us. It's going to be a ton of fun and maybe head out on one of her workshops. And you're like living the life. You know that, Erin, right?
I think so.
I think so too. You're doing it right. So, all right. Thank you so much for joining us. I can't wait for October. And
hey, Chris, thanks for having me.
Yeah, thank you. So we will talk with you soon. Thank you.
Okay, sounds good. Thank you. Bye-bye.
All right, bye-bye. All right, so if you didn't figure it out, we said there's like 15 spots left. It took me a while to get this podcast out because there's only a few spots left now. So go sign up, outofchicago.com, and check out Erin Bobnick. And hopefully you can come hang out with all of us at Out of Acadia, October 1st through the 5th. We have podcasts coming up with Scott Wieden-Kivowitz, with Gordon Lang of CameraLabs.com, and also with my favorite photographer and I should have said this in the beginning, just announced keynote speaker at the Out of Chicago Summer Conference, Art Wolf. So we'll be interviewing him coming up soon, and we'll see you there. Join us next time.